insight. As you all know, that insight is part of the Buddhist tradition. But many of you don't know what insight is. Sometimes we understand what insight is by its opposite. The opposite of insight is excite. So Buddhists don't get excited, they get incited. And to go insight, you have to look inside, because that's where insight is. Inside the experience which you are having now. And this is where we learn about the truth of things, where we find out the wisdom faculty which is latent within us. And when we learn how to look inside things, to read between the lines, to see the body language, to understand what's truly going on, we become very wise people. And when we become wise, we become very happy and very successful in our lives. And so insight is not just to become enlightened. Insight is also how to become successful in whatever you do. And maybe, hopefully I can remember some amazing stories of insight at work and how the capacity of the mind to see deeper into things than other people usually see will show you the importance of insight. One of the first things we do to get insight is I was talking so far in these series of talks which build upon each other, and started talking about mindfulness and the happiness of stillness. The more still one is, the more energy there is in the mind, the more one picks up. It's as if one can gather much more information about what's happening and thereby respond appropriately. For example, in my life as a monk, I just had an interview with a youth contingent, and sometimes you have to give talks with no preparation, sometimes you have to go on TV, but whether you're on TV or especially on radio, you have to be very insightful, you have to be sharp, on the ball. Because especially on talkback radio, and I've done a lot of talkback radio in my career so far, there you are, live, on air, and people are asking you a question. You have to respond appropriately, immediately. And if you say something wrong, if you make a fool of yourself, then it's repeated week after week after week. So to give you an understanding of what insight is, I remember going to a radio program one evening. You know, I have such a busy schedule, but there's no way I can find time during the day. So when this radio program asked me to come along for a show between 10 p.m. and midnight, I thought, yeah, I'm free then. I don't worry about sleep. I can always catch up on my sleep when I'm in my coffin. But now I've got energy, I might as well do something. So I accepted the invitation to go on talkback radio in a radio station, quite a popular one, in Perth. So after finishing a talk in Perth, I went to the radio station. I wasn't really late, but just made it on time. Went straight into the studio, and I said hello to the presenter, and there was another lady also on the microphone next to me. And it was only then that I found out what type of show it was. It was a show on adult themes about sex and relationships. And there I was, a monk, celibate for 32 years, answering questions about intimate matters. As I said, my mission is to go where no monk has ever gone before, to spread the Dhamma in places where you don't usually hear Dhamma. And it's fascinating being like a monk in the West, because when they asked my name and I said Ajahn Brahma Wangsa, they said, what? and they couldn't pronounce that. So even Ajahn Brahm was too much for them. So in the end, we decided to call me Mr. Monk. So soon I got a call addressed to Mr. Monk. This is an example of what insight is and how it works and how you have to see deeper into questions than other people see to get the right answers. And so the question came from a taxi driver in Perth, because late at night the taxi drivers often listen to the radio and they call in on their mobile phones with their questions. And so this Australian taxi man called in and said, "Now, Mr. Monk, I'd like to speak to Mr. Monk." He said, "I'm having an affair with another woman. My wife does not know. Is this all right?" Now, when you are training your mind, you don't just listen to the question, you listen to the questioner. So you go much deeper into the question. And so instead of saying yes it's right or no it's wrong, what I replied immediately was, "Sir, if it was right, you would not be ringing me up to ask." This is an example of what insight is. You see deeper into the problem. It was very clear to me that that man knew it was wrong to cheat on his wife. He did feel guilty, but he wanted to ask someone, some so-called expert. And if you're on a radio talkback show, you're supposed to be an expert. And they wanted an expert and authority to tell him yes, it was okay. In other words, to relieve his guilt. And so when I said, "Sir, if it was all right, you would not be ringing me up to ask," I hit the nail on the head. He saw what was going on. He knew it was wrong. And so he hung up the phone straight away. He just wanted someone to say it was okay. He knew it was wrong. So this is just an example of how insight works. You just see deeper into what's going on, even in ordinary daily life. One of the big problems you have, when I was talking with the youth a few moments ago, they asked, "Now, how can we make more Buddhism more relevant to young people?" And here we say, how do we make Buddhism more relevant to you guys and girls, to ordinary people? And one of your biggest problems in life is your relationships. Husband and wife, trying to get on together. And this is a place where insight practice can give you a very happy marriage. And without insight, you're going to have many arguments, and it's going to cause you a heap of suffering and pain. And sometimes in your life, there's more suffering in your marriage than anything else. So because of that, actually, do you know where the word marriage comes from in English? It comes from a word, an old Latin word, which means to gamble. Because it is a gamble when you choose a guy or a girl to settle down with. You don't really know what they're like, until you actually marry them. And so, it's a gamble, and it's an important part of people's lives. So how do we practice insight in a marriage? One of the things which I found in marriages, by counseling people, I found that there's, did I say the Hinayana, Mahayana marriage people here? No, I haven't. There's usually in a marriage, there is usually two people. And I think you know that there's two types of Buddhism. They're called Mahayana Buddhism and Hinayana Buddhism. And Hinayana Buddhism is looking at your own enlightenment, just for yourself, not really concerned with other people. It's like selfish. Mahayana is you forget about yourself and you just care for other people. You sacrifice yourself for others. Now, I just use that idea. It's got nothing to do with Theravada or Chinese Buddhism or Tibetan Buddhism, but I've used that idea for marriages. Because I've seen in many marriages that one partner is the Hinayana and the other one is the Mahayana. One partner just concerned about themselves, their own needs, and what they have to get, and the other partner just gives. And usually it's the man is the Hinayana partner and the girl is the Mahayana partner. And both are wrong. Which is why when I conduct marriage ceremonies or not the actual ceremonies but the blessings afterwards, I tell the happy couple and I said, from now on you should never think about yourself. And they all nod their head. Yes, we shouldn't think of ourselves anymore. And then I say, and you shouldn't think of your partner either. And then they look at me dazed. What do you mean I shouldn't think of my partner? And I say, if you think of the other, that's called Mahayana. If you think of yourself, that's called Hinayana. Both are dysfunctional. And those of you who've been in such marriages know that if you sacrifice for the other person, after a while you get so frustrated, burnt out, and you have no happiness. The same if you just think of yourself, you get no happiness either. So I said, you should never think of yourself, nor you should think of your partner. You should think of us. The insight in a marriage is not to think of the other person, not to think of yourself, but to think of us. You're a partnership. That insight is understanding a marriage works not by giving to the other person nor giving to yourself, but giving to the relationship. What I call the space between two people. It's how you relate to each other. What goes on between you. The connection between you. That's why we call it a relationship. So, in any marriage, you should never think of your partner, nor yourself. You think of what goes on between us. Because that's where the marriage lives, grows, or dies. You can see how this is like insight. You're seeing deeper into things than other people do. And in order to be sensitive to that relationship, that place between two people, where the action of a marriage happens, where it lives or dies, you need to be sensitive. To be sensitive, we have trainings in Buddhism, like meditation, which increases the sensitivity of your mind so you can hear, see, feel things which other people miss. In particular, in meditation, we've got something I call silent present moment awareness, otherwise known as total listening. Total listening means when somebody is speaking, you are silent. You are not second guessing what the other person is saying. For example, your husband comes home from work and he says, darling, I need to say something to you, blah blah blah, and you start thinking, here he goes again, I wish he'd shut up, how many times do I have to listen to this, blah blah blah. You're not listening to what he's saying. There's another commentary going on inside of you. It's the same with the husband. Very rarely does he listen to his wife. Too often, she speaks and he turns off. Because you're not listening to each other with this total listening, opening your minds absolutely silent to soak everything in, you're not hearing what's being said. And you don't just listen to the words, you even listen to the body language, to the tone of the voice. Even when you have mindfulness, this silent listening, so all your senses are open to what's happening, you pick up so much. And when you pick up so much, you understand what that person is really trying to tell you. Because sometimes, even to our loved ones, we never say exactly what we mean. We beat around the bush, as they say. We go around things.
because we don't want to say specifically what we mean. And sometimes we're not clear what we mean. We don't know how to express it. But when you listen well, through total listening, you can pick up what the person means to say. And then there is that communication. You have deep insight into what the other person is meaning and where they're coming from. So often, when a person criticizes you in a marriage, when they get upset and they scold you, and you think, what have I done? I've done nothing. Why are you getting angry at me? It's true, you haven't done anything. They get angry at you because they love you. Because they think you will understand that you're just letting off steam because you're upset, angry, or tired. Which is why many, many couples who come to me for advice, when their husband comes home and starts yelling at them, instead of feeling that they should defend themselves, all they do is give their husband a big hug and say, I understand, darling. In other words, you haven't done anything wrong. It's just your husband is upset, tired, something's happened in the office, and he's just letting off steam. If you can really listen and understand where people are coming from, all the misunderstandings of a marriage, all the misunderstandings in the office, even all the misunderstandings in a temple, they sort of disappear. Your insight creates more harmony in the world. Another example of insight was the story, and I'm going to take the story deeper, so I don't think you've heard this before. Once there were two monks, and they saw a flag. And one of the monks said, do you see that flag flapping in the wind? And the one said, no, the flag isn't flapping, the wind is moving. And the other one said, no, the flag is moving. The other said, the wind is moving. So they went to see the master, and the Zen master said, you're both wrong, the mind is moving. Now, that's not the end yet. Because then they went to see a Theravada forest monk. And the forest monk said, you monk were wrong, the flag wasn't moving, that's not the problem. The wind moving is not the problem. And your mind moving is not the problem, that's the nature of a mind to move. Your problem, monks, the reason why you were arguing, because your mouth was moving. Now that's the insight. If you in a marriage would stop your mouth moving, you wouldn't have so many problems, would you? So that's why that sometimes just being quiet solves hundreds of problems. Insight is seeing deeper into things than other people do. And when you can develop your insight through some total listening, through stillness, you pick up more of what's happening. My teacher Ajahn Chah used to call it like looking at the leaves in the forest. It's a great little story of insight. Because in the forest monasteries of Northeast Thailand where I grew up, the jungles were full of dangerous animals, like snakes and centipedes and scorpions. And the snakes were very, very dangerous. When I first went there, they said there were 100 species of snake in Thailand. 99 were venomous. If they bit you, you'd be in big trouble. And the other one, the 100th one, would strangle you to death. So they were all dangerous. And actually, it's one of my snake stories I love telling. I think yesterday I told you that once a week we'd always stay up all night meditating. That was what we used to do over there. Once a week on the moon days, we would forego our sleep at night and we meditate throughout the night. And one of those days, after completing the all-night meditation, I went outside of the meditation hall to urinate in the forest because there wasn't that many monks, and it was a very natural forest, so you could, you know, urinate on the bushes. And as I squatted down in the first light of dawn, now remember it was first light of dawn, so it wasn't very clear, and I was quite dull and sleepy after being up all night, and as I squatted down to urinate, I thought I was urinating on a stick. And then the stick started to move. I was peeing on a snake. And one of the most sensitive parts of the male anatomy was only a few inches from that snake's mouth. It was very dangerous. But did that snake bite me? Of course it didn't. Because that snake recognized it was being blessed by holy water. It's not every day that a snake gets blessed by a buck. Anyway, that's a true story. Don't make these things up. Back to insight. Because there were so many snakes and scorpions and, you know, these biting ants as well, that we had to sweep the paths every day. That meant that when you were walking on the path, you could actually see if there was any snake or dangerous animal on that path and take preventative action. But if you were actually walking through the forest itself, you didn't know where you were stepping on, or what you were urinating on either. So, when we would sweep those paths, they'd be so clear and free from leaves, that when a leaf actually fell on that path for the first time, it really stood out. You could see it clearly. But if a leaf fell amongst all the hundreds of other leaves, you could hardly make it out at all. And Ajahn Chah used that simile. To get real insight, you have to have a very still and clear mind. And then when a thought, an event happens, it's as if it's an event which falls on a clear swept path, like a leaf, and you can really understand what it is. Too often in life, we're so complicated, we're doing so much, so many things to think about, we can't really understand anything. We have to uncomplicate our minds sometimes to get real insight. So this is why insight usually comes from a clear, still mind, which is really listening, which is open, which can hear, which can see more deeply than other people can. And when you can see very deeply and understand, it's very easy to overcome the problems in life. I did give a talk on overcoming the problems, but it's how to overcome those problems. With insight, you see deeper and you see solutions to problems. For example, once upon a time, there was a donkey. He was an old donkey and a little bit blind. And when he was walking through some woods, he fell into a well. Fortunately, the well was dry and he never broke any bones. But there was the donkey at the bottom of a well. And donkeys can't climb out of wells. So the poor old donkey was in a difficult situation. He was in a fix at the bottom of a well. So he started making noises. Ah, ah. I can't really do donkeys, that's the best I can do. Ah, ah. And he had to do his ah, ah for a long time, trying to get somebody's attention. Otherwise he'd die of starvation and thirst at the bottom of that well. Ah, ah. And after a couple of hours, someone actually heard the strange sound. And when he followed the sound, there he saw the poor donkey at the bottom of a well. Trouble was, that person who found the donkey was an old farmer. And the farmer never liked that donkey. And he looked at the situation, that stupid old donkey is at the bottom of that well. And you know, that's a dangerous well as well. Sometimes people can fall into that well. Why don't I solve two problems at the same time? Let's fill in that well with the donkey at the bottom, thought the cruel farmer. So he started shoveling dirt into that well. And it fell right on top of the donkey. Shovelful after shovelful. And the donkey didn't understand what was happening to him. And then he finally figured out that that cruel and wicked farmer was burying him alive. And so the donkey went, ah, ah, ah. He started making louder donkey noises. This is what donkeys do in Australia. Maybe not in Malaysia. Maybe. And he made terrible sounds, as you would when you are being killed in such a mean and wicked way, having dirt thrown all over you, buried alive. Then suddenly the donkey went quiet. Farmer thought he must have killed the donkey already. And so he kept on shoveling, but not so fast. He was taking his time, shoveling the earth in to complete burying the well with the donkey on the bottom. But what had happened? Donkey got insight. The donkey figured out what was happening and found his solution. Every time a shovelful of earth went on top of the donkey, he simply shrugged it off without moaning, stamped it under his feet, and he found he was a millimeter or two higher. Another shovelful of earth, shrug it off, stamp it in, another centimeter higher. Farmer never saw what was going on because he couldn't see into the well. He was busily shuffling. And the farmer never saw two ears appear above the top of the well. He never saw a head appear above the well. He was so busy shuffling, he never saw the donkey got high enough to jump out. And according to the story, he bit the farmer on the back and ran off. The moral of that story is, whenever people shovel dirt on you, they scold you, they criticize you, don't get angry back. Don't go, ah, 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 like a stupid donkey of a person. Whenever anybody shovels dirt on you, simply shrug it off, stamp it in, and you're a millimeter or two higher. I told that story to a politician in Singapore a year or two ago when he was having a lot of trouble with the press. He appreciated that story because as politicians, sometimes you get dirt thrown over you. There's no need to go, ah, ah, ah. Just shrug it off, stamp it in, and you're a little bit higher. So that's what insight is. When you have problems in life, you don't complain. You don't make a noise. You make use of it. Shrug it off, stamp it in, and you become a higher being. So these insights which we have, they all come from actually stillness. Too often when we try and find solutions to problems, we think too much. And that's not the Buddhist way of insight. That's excite again. We're looking outside of things. To really understand solutions and find out new ways of thinking and doing things, we have to be still. I think each one of you has probably got an MP3 player at home. Some of you have got iPods, where you can have all the talks of Ajahn Brahm, everything which I've ever said in my whole life on this tiny little stick. It really sort of destroys me. Is that all the work I've done and it's in such a small stick? But it's not just that. You can have Dharma talks, you can have music, you can have so much. How do they get so much information in such a small space? MP3 compression. You know where that came from? There was a mathematician, I forget what his name was, in the US, who was doing research on chaos theory. It's a branch of mathematics. Actually, it bridges mathematics and physics. And he had a problem. One night, when he was asleep, he had a dream. And the dream was all of these, like, telephone cables, completely messed up, a complete tangle. and he saw the way to untangle them. At the same time, he saw the solution to the problem he was working on. How to use such chaos theory to simplify, to get a sample of information and see that that could represent the whole. To a small sample will be enough to replicate the whole. And that's the technique, the idea, which actually underpins your MP3 player. He discovered that, and obviously made himself a fortune as well as a famous name, when he was not thinking about it, when he was silent, when he was asleep. As so many of the great ideas come to people when they're not thinking about it. When you're thinking about it, you're missing the point. Some of the greatest insights come in silence. There's another scientist I know, Josephson. He invented what's called the Josephson Junction. I'm not sure if there's any IT people here, any computer people. But he found a way of replicating the semiconductor at very, very low temperatures, close to absolute zero. Because at such low temperatures, there's a phenomenon known as superconductivity. So the information get processed so fast. And so it's going to be a new generation of computers run close to absolute zero, which ran so fast and therefore could compute so much. And his invention, the Josephson Junction, he saw that, he was from Cambridge, a few years after me, he saw that when he was meditating. So often, the great insights, the different ways of seeing things, actually come through stillness. So insight is seeing deep into things, total listening, being still, and you see things which other people just don't see. I told this story, not here, but on the first day when I went to Adana. This is a story of an Australian man. He was wandering in the mountains of the Himalayas with a trekking party. And because he was a bit slow and he was looking at other places, he lost the main group. And he got lost. Now, being lost in the foothills of the Himalayas can be very, very dangerous. Fortunately, when it got close to darkness, before it got too dark, he saw the lights of a monastery. So he went to that monastery, knocked on the door, they let him in. He needed some place to shelter for the night, and the abbot kindly gave him a room. But what happened was, around midnight, laying in his room, he was woken up by the most wonderful sound you could ever hear. It was supernatural in its beauty. You don't hear music like that or chanting like that anywhere. And it was so inspiring, beautiful, supernatural, that in the morning when he saw the abbot to take leave to go home, the abbot had arranged a guide to take him back to the party. He asked the abbot, "Last night, around midnight, I heard this amazing sound. It was the most beautiful thing I'd ever heard, and I've heard great orchestras playing at Carnegie Hall. I've heard the Berlin Philharmonic. I've heard the greatest opera singers. I've even heard the chanting at Champaka Buddhist Lodge." "But this exceeded everything I've ever heard. What was that?" And the abbot looked at him and said, "I'm terribly sorry, sir, but I can't tell you. You have to be a monk to understand what that is." And he said, "Look, I'm an Australian, you can tell me. I won't tell anybody else, promise." He said, "Sorry, I can't tell you, you're not a monk." And no matter what that Australian did, he couldn't get information out of that abbot. And he had to go back to find the party, so he left the monastery, said thank you, But when he got back to Australia, he couldn't get that experience out of his mind. He had to find out what was that sound he'd heard. It was driving him crazy because it was the most beautiful, wonderful thing he'd ever heard in his life. So 1 year later, he went back to Nepal. He found that monastery, knocked on the door, had an audience with the abbot, and said, "Abbot, this has been driving me crazy. I can't sleep at night. I can't do my work. I've got to find out what that sound was." And the abbot said quite kindly, "Look, I told you, I can't tell you, you're not a monk." But he said, "Look, I know that. Ordain me as a monk." It's either that or going crazy. And the abbot said, "This is a very strict monastery. It will take 7 years before you can be ordained. I don't care. I go mad if I don't find that source of that sound." So the abbot ordained him as a monk. And it took him 7 years of preliminary training before the abbot gave him the ordination ceremony. And after he was ordained, the first thing he asked the abbot, "Right, tell me what that sound is. I've waited 8 years. I've gone through all this training. Please, you have to tell me what that supernatural sound is." And the abbot said, "Now you're a monk, I can tell you. Come to my room just before midnight and I'll show you." So he was very, very, very excited. He was at the abbot's room at 11 o'clock waiting. At 11:45, a quarter to midnight, the abbot let him in. "Now I will show you what that sound is." And you can imagine how excited that Australian man was. At last he will find the source of a sound he would never forget the rest of his life. The abbot opened a drawer and took out a bunch of keys. And he led the monk to a part of the monastery where only the abbot can go. They came to a big wooden door, and the abbot got out the bunch of keys, and one of those keys was a wooden key, which he used to open up this ancient wooden door. And when he opened the door, the Australian started hearing this sound again, and it was just so inspiring, it brought tears to his eyes. Especially now, he would find its source. They walked down the corridor until they came to a big iron door. And the abbot got out an iron key, put it in the lock, and opened another very old door. And the sound became louder and more thrilling. It just moved his heart so much, it was so beautiful and wonderful. And they walked a few meters further down the corridor, when they came to the silver door. The silver door, solid silver, maybe 6 inches thick, would be worth a fortune on the market. He took out a silver key, turned it in the lock and opened that. And now he could hear the sound so clearly, but he still couldn't see its source. The most beautiful sound you could ever imagine. Actually, much more than you could imagine. And finally they came to the last door. A solid gold door, encrusted with priceless jewels. His heart was beating. He was soon to see the source of the sound. And the abbot took out the gold key. The final key, opening the final door. And he opened that final door, and there, at last, the Australian saw the source of that sound. You know what it was? "I can't tell you, you're not monks." Did I catch you? So when you have insight, you should have insight in areas where you can really find out something. So is there a God or not? "I can't tell you, you're not dead yet."
Too often we look at insight into the wrong place. And we waste too much time, like in that story. So real insight is actually finding out things which are really going to be helpful for you. Like, what's the meaning of life? Who are you? What is life all about? There's a story which I wrote in my book, Opening the Door of Your Heart, which is a wonderful metaphor of insight and understanding the meaning of life. And this was a story which again comes from my own experience of life. Because when I was just turned 18, after I'd finished school, before I went up to Cambridge University, and I did very well and did my scholarship exams about 7 months before I went up to Cambridge. So I had a whole period of time where I was free of studies. And so I decided to travel to experience some of the world. One of the places I went to was United States, but that bored me because it was just similar to the West, which I knew. And I decided to go and see some of the jungles of Central America. In particular, there was a civilization called the Mayan civilization in southern Mexico and northeastern Guatemala and the Yucatan Peninsula, which always fascinated me. I don't know why. These were also a culture which raised these huge pyramids in the jungle, similar but quite different in other respects to the Egyptian pyramids, but just as high. And so I decided to go and visit these places. In particular, there was a site called Tikal in the middle of the Guatemalan jungles. And in those days, it was 1969, it was very difficult to get to. I had to journey first to Guatemala City and then to go to the Caribbean coast, where there was a fishing boat leaving at midnight, and the fishing boat would go up the coast and then down a river which separated Guatemala from Belize, otherwise known as British Honduras, I think it was called. And up that river, and this was like a scene out of a Tarzan movie. There was jungle on either side, no roads, Indians going naked in dugout canoes. This was places which hadn't changed in thousands of years. And at the end of the river, there was a dirt road, and you got on top of a truck and traveled through the jungle paths, single track roads, to eventually come to this site in the middle of the jungle where there was a series of ancient pyramids. Now, first of all, it took me about 3 days to get there from Guatemala City, even though it was only about 150 miles. And I want to tell you that when you have a jungle, just like in Malaysia, but you cut a track through it, the jungle is so alive with growth, within a couple of months, the track gets covered over with trees and foliage. So I remember those roads and tracks which I went on were like tunnels through the jungle. You couldn't see the sky above except through gaps in the leaves. Even the river was covered over, so you never saw far distances. For 3 days, I'd just been traveling through green tunnels. And when I finally got to the site, there was one or two archaeologists fossicking around, but there was no other travellers there. It was just too difficult to get to. And no police, no guards, no people selling souvenirs. It was too pristine for that. And so I had freedom to do whatever I wanted. And being a young man, I saw my first pyramid and thought, let's climb to the top. That's what young men do. You know, like conquering Mount Everest, I was going to conquer a pyramid. But it was a wonderful thing to do, and what was so important, I did not know from any guidebook what those pyramids were there for. But as soon as I climbed my first pyramid, I had an insight.
I understood why those big buildings had been constructed in the middle of jungle, in a civilization which had disappeared, and no one knows why to this day, about 500 years ago. Because when I got to the top of that pyramid, I noticed that the pyramid was just above the tree line. On top of the pyramid was a small little house, if you like, a one-room building. And you just got up to that building, and you were above the level of the trees. It was the first time in 3 days that I could see the horizon. And that was so startling to me, at last, to see great distances, that many insights came to me. As I looked down from above, I could see the path from which I'd come that day. There was a village called Flores, maybe only about 15 miles away, and that's where I'd been that night before. And you could see it in the distance. You could see the path. You could see the rivers we'd crossed. When you were above and outside of the jungle, looking down from on top, you could see the plan of the world below you. And I thought, what would it have been like hundreds of years ago if some priest or holy person took a young boy or young girl for the very first time on top of that pyramid? For the very first time in their life, they'd be able to see their world, the place where they lived, the villages, the paths, the rivers, all laid out before them. I understood that this would be an insight into their world and where they fit in. But more than that, on top of that pyramid, they would look around, and for the first time in their lives, they would see great distances. They'd see infinity in all directions, with nothing between them and the infinite. They'd see the great emptiness which surrounds us all, which doesn't separate us, but embraces us and connects us. I realized that the experience of going to the top of a pyramid and looking at life from above, seeing the plan and seeing infinity in all directions, was a metaphor for spiritual insight. Because this is what insight has to be. Somehow we have to step out of our world to get an objective view, to climb some tower or pyramid so we can look down upon our life and see our plan, to see the roads, the villages, the rivers and lakes all laid out in front of us, and to see the infinite in all directions. This is what insight truly is. Through developing the deep meditations, you are temporarily leaving the world, leaving the office, leaving the husband, wife, the kids, the money, the concerns. Because when you leave it for a little while, it's like climbing out and above and beyond. And from that vantage point, you look and see. Only then do you understand the meaning of your life, and why these things happen to you, and why these events actually occur. You see the plan of your life, and you see the great emptiness which surrounds us all. That is a beautiful description of what happens in insight. You climb that pyramid, you see the truth of things, and then you come down again afterwards to live your life and to tell other people. Insight is needed before you can work compassionately in this world. You've got to know what the world is all about and have wisdom. Because without that wisdom, we make far too many mistakes in life. We are compassionate and kind, but without wisdom, born of insight, we usually make far too many mistakes. I remember reading in a magazine one such mistake which happened once. There was a young boy who was born deaf. Every few months, his parents would take him to see the doctor to have a checkup. On one such visit, the doctor was very excited because he'd read in a medical journal about an operation which had been pioneered in the West, which restored 10% of children who'd been born without hearing and restored their hearing. It only worked in 10% of cases, but according to this deaf boy's doctor, that boy looked like he could be one of those 10%. So he asked the parents, should we give the operation? It's not expensive, and you got 1 in 10 chance of restoring your son's hearing. If you were a parent and that was your child, would you go for the operation? Those parents did. They said, yeah, let's give it a try. And that child was one of the 10%. His hearing was fully restored. After the operation, that boy was so upset and angry at his parents. He said, why didn't you ask me if I wanted to hear? Said, now I'm stuck with this terrible noise. And he said, it's such a pain and a distraction. I didn't want to hear. Obviously, when they were discussing it, he didn't know what they were saying. And they assumed, as I did, that everybody would want to hear. Why don't you ask the person, first of all? That's what insight is. Being able to ask and listening. I've said this to many people over the years, because each one of you may have the terrible situation of going to the hospital to see maybe your old mother or father and being asked by the doctor whether you should turn off the machine or not. With the advances of medical science, we can keep our old people going on artificial life support for days and days, weeks and weeks, months and months. Many of you might remember that Terry Schiavo case in the United States, where there was a woman who was on artificial life support for several years, and it became such a huge issue that even the politicians in Congress and Senate started to get involved. But that can happen to you. So what would you do if your mother, say, was in the hospital on artificial life support, the doctor told you that there was hardly any chance of survival? Would you turn off your mother's life support system? Is that murder? Is that breaking precepts? What is it? Or if that happens to be your dog or cat, someone you've grown up with and loved for many years, and you go to the vet and the vet says your dog has got cancer, it's going to die painfully, can I put it down? In other words, kill it. What would you do? These are real situations where Buddhist insight should give you a much better answer than just yes or no. Because yes or no answers, they don't really make any sense. Happened to a friend of mine. They had a big golden Labrador dog. They're beautiful dogs, the golden Labradors. And they only had an ear infection. And took it to the vet. The vet picked it up, looked at its ear, looked underneath it, and said, I'm terribly sorry, I'm going to have to put your dog down. He said, what? He's only got an ear infection. What are you going to put it down for? Vet said, because it's heavy. It's a joke. Or the other man who took his dog to the vet, and the dog was dead. But because the man was in denial, because he loved his dog so much, the man insisted on giving it a proper checkup to confirm it was really dead. The vet said, it's dead. The man said, no, I'm sure it's just sleeping or in a coma or something. Give it a proper investigation. So the vet decided, I'll give it a proper investigation. He got a cat out of one of the cages. You know, like cats and dogs, what they're like. And he put the cat's nose right at the back side of the dog. And the dog didn't move. He put the cat right in front of the dog's snout. The cat, ah! What doesn't go, ah? It goes, what does the cat do? It's, whatever it does, hisses. And still the dog didn't move. And the vet put the cat on the dog's stomach. And still the dog didn't move. There, said the vet, your dog is dead. And the owner had to admit, because the dog never liked cats, and getting the cat so close meant the dog was obviously dead. So the man said, okay, fair enough. But the vet said, I'm going to give you a bill now. And the bill was for 4,000 Australian dollars.
What? He said, that's a bit steep.
He said, well, it's actually $4,050. $50 was for my examination, and $4,000 was for the CAT scan. Anyway, back to real vets. If that is your dog or cat, what would you do? The answer is, and I've told this to many people and it works, ask the dog. Ask the dog whether it's ready to die or not. Because if that's your dog or cat and you've known it for many years, you love it. You do have a connection there. And if you ask your dog, look into its eyes and say, are you ready to die yet? You'll feel straight away, intuitively, what to do. And whatever you feel, follow that. You're doing the dog's bidding, the cat's bidding, not yours. Sometimes your dog or cat has had enough. It says, yes, I want to go. It's not your karma, it's dog's karma. Recently, a lady, a close disciple in Perth, I've known her for many years, that happened to her dog. Dog had cancer, and the vet said, there's no hope of survival. It's going to really hurt and be in pain. Can I put it down? And she remembered my saying. And so she said, can I have a few minutes with my dog? And she looked at the dog and asked, do you want to die? And she felt very clear the dog say no. So she took the dog home. The dog made a full recovery, to the great surprise of the vet. And now is just full remission, wagging its tail, running around like a little puppy. And she told me that story and said, thank you so much for that piece of advice, because it worked. The dog knew that it wasn't terminal, and the dog is sometimes much smarter than the vet. And that's what you should do if it's your father or mother, or maybe your husband, or even a child after a great accident. If they're on the artificial life support systems, and the doctor says there's no quality of life, actually they're just being kept alive by artificial means, what do you do? It's a dilemma which happens to more and more people with greater regularity because of our modern life. What Buddhism says, ask them. But they're in a coma. Ask them. And if you ask the question, you're actually arousing insight. And you listen very carefully. You feel it in your heart. They're still there. They don't want to go yet. And then you say, no, another day. Couple of days, whatever. See what happens. Because sometimes people do make those miraculous recoveries. I know people have made those recoveries. The doctor said they're gone. The doctor was begging the children to turn off the life support systems and they recovered completely. Other times it's just a waste of time and money. Other times you ask that question. Do you want to die? Is there anyone there? And if that's someone so close to you, you know intuitively they're gone. Then you say, turn off the life support machine. You're not killing them. They've already died. You feel that. You know that. You're just stopping supporting what is now no more than a machine. A body which is not sustained by the being anymore. They've gone. And you feel that.
Now this is what insight is. You're actually asking a question. You're getting the answer inside of you. And please develop that insight. The inner understanding of what to do in your life. You have to total listen, as I began this talk by saying that total listening is the sensitivity, not thinking too much, but being quiet and able to listen between the words, between the lines, listen in the silence, to know what's happening, and to know what the appropriate thing to do is. And even in business it's the same. Sometimes if you want to actually get your competitive edge on business, to be resourceful, to be innovative, and to actually to make it in this world, even using insight in your company is very, very important. For example, listen to your customers. Be silent and totally listen to them. As I listen to my customers, you. Customer service, that's the name of my game. So, do you ever notice that when I give a talk, I'm always looking at you? I scan you to listen to you, to see what you're thinking. That's actually how I give talks, to relate to you. So in the same way in your business, my business is very successful. In your business, listen to your customers. Silently, intuitively, you find out what they need. That's actually, I remember reading the story of Dell, who founded Dell Computers. That's actually how he got started. Now, he just bought some old computers and refigured them and sold them. And he refigured them like no one else did, because he actually listened to what people wanted from their computers. And that's how he started. And it's, of course, one of the huge companies in our modern world that started from scratch. Was in the last 20 or 30 years? Maybe not that long. This is what you can do if you listen and have insight and find out what people need. And also listening to your staff, listening to the other people in your office, so you find out what's wanted, what's needed. That insight, that sensitivity, is what works. And that's why I get invited to give these talks to the CEOs. These things are very, very powerful. Later on I'll talk about insight, which leads to enlightenment, but that's only for the yogis on retreat. This is insight which leads to your happiness, well-being, and answers the question in your life. So don't always look in the books for the answers. Don't just ask the expert. You are the expert. Listen to yourself. What you need. Even in the silence of your heart, you can hear what your body wants. I mentioned this on my mindfulness talk. People get sick and have cancers because they never listen. The body tells them again and again and again, you're working too hard. Your wife keeps on telling you, our relationship is not strong, something's going wrong. But you don't listen until it's too late. Life tells you there's problems. We're always looking somewhere else. Insight is seeing where the action is. Being here, listening. And it's amazing how much you find out, how much you learn, and how happy and successful you become. That's what insight is. It's not different than your daily life. It enhances and solves your problems. Thank you for listening. Okay. Any live questions from the audience now?
or any dead questions on pieces of paper? Okay, there's one live question here anyway. Does the vineyard rules allow lay devotees to hug a monk or a nun as a show of affection? If not, what's the reason for the prohibition? Well, the reason is, there are many, say, I know Catholic priests who've been sued because a hug is sometimes seen as sexual assault, especially in Western countries. And I don't think Champaka Buddhist Lodge could afford the lawyer's fees. No, you say. So the reason is usually that when you're a monk or a nun, you're celibate. And because you're celibate, you have to be very careful of sexuality. And a hug can be not just a show of affection, but also a show of sensuality as well. So because of that, the Buddha said, no, no hugs. You can spread diseases that way. So no hugs, but you can always say thank you. Even saying that, I admit I was kissed once. I'll tell you the story. It was one of our neighbours in Australia. You know, I got to know him very well because he was a neighbour. He wasn't a Buddhist, but I don't care. But you know, your friends were the people you live close to. He was a farmer next door. And especially when he lost his wife, I really counselled him and looked after him a lot. And so he really respected me. So when he died, now I was invited to his funeral, of course. And at his funeral, the funeral's in the West, after we do the service, then usually the next of kin, you know, you go up to them and give your consolations and say, you know, hope you are okay. And usually the next of kin, you give them a hug. But I sort of stood back, because she went to hug me. This was this man's daughter, Coralie. She went to hug me and I said, I'm sorry, not allowed to do that. Now this was a farmer's daughter who is used to catching sheep and wrestling them to the ground. So when I said, no, you're not allowed to do that, she said, yes I am! And she was so quick I couldn't escape. In that case it was completely unintentional, so it didn't matter. So she got me. So if you can wrestle sheep, you may be able to get me again, but I'm much quicker these days. So you're not allowed to do that. And the same, like a nun is not allowed to hug a man. So it's not a gender thing, it's like a celibacy, non-celibacy thing. Because what would happen if your wife hugged me, and you think, what's he doing with my wife? That was a long hug. And you get into trouble. How many of you have read my book, Opening the Door of Your Heart? Put your hand up. There's actually less than half. There's a story in there, a true story. I told this in Perth many years ago. You all remember there was a time when many monks, especially Thai monks, were getting caught with women. And they were very, very naughty monks. And they created a huge problem for Buddhism. So at that time I decided to make a confession in front of all my regular disciples in Perth. I put my head to the ground and said, this is hard for me to say, but I need to say this. He said, some years ago I spent some of the happiest moments of my life in the loving arms of another man's wife. We kissed, we hugged. It was another man's wife. When I said that, I could hear people say, oh no, not Ajahn Brahm too. And some disciples went to the door straight away. I mean, that's adultery, isn't it? In the loving arms of another man's wife, kissing. Then I explained, I said, it was many years ago when I was a young baby. That was my mother. It was another man's wife. It was my mum. We had some of the wonderful times, hugging and kissing. So it's true, isn't it? You can't. But the trouble is, the reason I said that, that so often, what we hear, we jump to conclusions. And too often in marriage, you say something, you jump to a conclusion, and it's the wrong conclusion. And many people thought, my goodness, Ajahn Brahm has been hugging and kissing, you know, as a monk, another man's wife. When I explained it to him, it meant what I said made sense. It wasn't lying, but people jumped to the wrong conclusion. And too often, we can jump to the wrong conclusion. So because of that, it's much better we don't hug. Because otherwise, you don't know what's Ajahn Brahm up to, what's the monks up to, what's that nun up to. She only seems to hug hot boys, not old men. Something's wrong there. Anyway, what are your comments on the practice of a famous Indian nun called Amma who heals her devotees by hugging them? If it heals them, that's what's wrong with that? So as long as she doesn't squash them. Is it easy for a meditator to recognize another meditator who's attained jhana? What indication to look for? What indication to look for is a nice, happy smile. Like a happiness which is not of the world. So they're just so nice and so soft and so beautiful. But it's usually if somebody's attained those things, you ask them lots of questions to find out what they're really up to. Because these are deep meditations and sometimes people miss it. So usually you have to see a teacher and the teacher will actually find out what you're up to. But it doesn't matter whether it's a jhana or not a jhana. As long as you're getting deep meditation and happiness, that's good enough. A serious vipassana practitioner has often remarked, Ajahn Brahm joked too much with the Dhamma. What have you got to say to this critic? Well, it's okay to criticize me. So, my heart is open to you, monk, whoever you are, even if you criticize me, because I won't allow even any other monk to control my happiness. And Ajahn Chah joked a lot. And look, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. Isn't it a wonderful way of spreading the Dhamma? And I think I've made many more people become Buddhists, and also to practice the Dhamma and come to temples, encouraging your children to come to temples. So let the people decide whether I joke too much or don't joke enough. So you decide. My grandfather passed away recently. Dear Ajahn, may I know what I can do to help him in case he is reborn in an undesirable realm like the animal realm or the ghost realm? And how can I persuade my parents to understand it? We don't know where your grandfather has been passed away to. Find out whether he's a good boy, a good grandfather or a bad grandfather. If he's been a good person, he always goes to good places, so you don't have to worry about him. But you can always do sort of kind acts to him, and if you really think he's been reborn in the animal realm, then you better look after some animals. Don't kill cockroaches. That might be your grandfather. Be careful. And if a ghost comes to you, be kind to the ghost. That's just your grandfather coming around. And ghosts can be very helpful. You know, some ghosts, they know lottery numbers. So if your grandfather says, come on, granddad, you know, do the right thing. So in the meantime, you can always do some good karma and share merits. And even if it doesn't get to him, still you get the merits. So when you make merits and you share it to other people, you don't lose anything. It's always win-win situation. You win because you made the merits, and your grandfather might win because you share them with him. So you don't lose anything there. Ajahn Brahm, what is marriage? You've asked the experts. Have you ever heard the saying that love is blind? So marriage is an institution for the blind? I think I said that the other day. No, that marriage is two people coming together. And is what you make out of it can be very spiritual and very rewarding. It's an opportunity for you to be selfless. Because before, you know, you only think of yourself. But when you're married, there's a pair there. So you have to be selfless. And also you have to be restrained. Because in a marriage, sure, you girls will see another guy you really like. You see another girl you like if you're a man. That's the nature of being a man or a girl. But you have to restrain yourself. So that restraint is very similar to what a monk does. Now you have got one partner, you have to stop getting involved in other people. I have to stop getting involved in everybody. But it's still a restraint there in order for happiness. So because of that, there's lots of similarities. If you take a marriage properly, there's a lot of letting go, a lot of compromise, a lot of sensitivity. And eventually when you have children, you're bringing up people in the world, and you have an extra responsibility to make sure that you are practicing well and being good parents, because there's another being that's depending upon what you do and what you say. If you get drunk, your child sees that, and they're liable to get drunk. If you smoke, your child is going to smoke. If you gamble, what do you think your children is going to do? So, and a marriage gives you an opportunity for a spiritual practice. It really depends on how you make the marriage work. It really is up to you. A lot of people take marriage as a signature on a piece of paper. What does Buddhism take on marriage? Marriage is a commitment. And as I said in my book, when you just go out or you just live with somebody, because it's very common in the Western world now, I don't know if it happens in Malaysia, that boys and girls, instead of having a marriage ceremony, they just buy an apartment together and just live together. That's called involvement. Marriage is called commitment. And if you want to know the difference between involvement and commitment, as I said in my book, it's the difference, the same difference between bacon and eggs. In bacon and eggs, the pig is committed, the chicken is only involved. So if you just shack up together, live together, it's just a chicken arrangement. You just give part of yourself. You don't give everything, like a pig does to bacon. Chicken only gives one egg, got many left. A marriage, you give your whole being to that marriage. That's why it's called commitment. And it's much more different than just living with somebody. What you're saying by signing a piece of paper, it's not just signing a paper, it's going through a ceremony in front of all your friends and relations. What you're saying is that I commit myself to that girl, and I'm so proud of it, I'm so sure I'm doing it in public, in front of all the people who matter to me. And the girl said, I commit myself to that young man. And you're saying it in public before all the people you really love and care for. And by doing it in public like that, it has a far greater psychological power over you. And that commitment will keep you together over those first years of marriage, which are the hard ones. When you're really committed together, you find you can make it work in nearly all cases. Sometimes it doesn't. You have to sort of try again. But in most cases, commitment means you can work it through. And it's the working through the problems in a marriage where you get to the next level of love. You know, the bonding of being through many difficult situations, but working through them together. And that's in the later years of a marriage. If you've done it properly, you are so close together. It literally is your other half. You've been so close together, you are a pair whose roots have intertwined. You could hardly be separated. Ajahn, can enlightenment come from Q&A? I don't know, has anyone been enlightened yet after all these sessions here? Like Chinese Zen Master do. What is the difference between first jhana, second jhana, and Sotapanna Anagami? Jhanas are just they're powerful states of mind. Very often they're causes for enlightenment, but they're not enlightenment themselves. The Buddha said, verse 372 of the Dhammapada, Nati jānaṁ apanyasa panya nati ajayato yam hi jānaṁ ca panya ca sa ve nibbāna santike, which you all know means there is no jhana without wisdom, there's no wisdom without jhana. This is the words of the Buddha, no jhana without wisdom, no wisdom without jhana. So you have to have them together. Jhanas are not stupid states for people who are dull. You have to be wise to have jhana, but there's no real wisdom without jhana. They go together as a pair. And the last two lines were, in the one who has jhana and wisdom, they are in the presence of nibbana. They're knocking on the door of nibbana. So you need jhana and wisdom. You get those two together, you're so close. When it is disputed in an organization or even sangha, should the activities of the organization stop or monastery? If there's any dispute, just mediate the dispute. Find out a way of solving it. And if it's a Buddhist organization, remember you're Buddhist. What would the Buddha do? And if there's any dispute in my monastery, I'm very embarrassed it got to that stage. We're Buddhist, for goodness sake. Shouldn't the Buddhists have more letting go and compassion? So, if someone else says, I want to be president, and say, no, I'm president. In a Buddhist organization, say, oh, you be president. He said, no, you be president. So, no, come on, you be president. That's what Buddhism is always like. It's just so much letting go, so much kindness and gentleness. And in the end, if there is an argument, find out why. So we stop and talk to each other. We don't go too far in the argument to the point we get upset at each other. We just stop, take time out, and remember what's really important. Many of you know my story. Goodness, heaps of questions. When I first went to Perth, I was number two monk, and there was another monk ahead of me. He was the abbot. When we built our main hall, which is there in our monastery, you see our main meditation hall, we had an argument. He wanted to build it one way, I wanted to build it another way. And I was a very skilled builder, and I was sure I was right. And his hall was a stupid hall. It would be hot, low maintenance, high maintenance, silly thing to do. We had an argument for about a week. And it was only after a week I came to my senses. And I went to his room, knocked on the door. And in Buddhism we have a way of asking forgiveness with candles, incense and flowers. So I knocked on his door, can I come? What do you want? And I asked forgiveness from him for arguing with him about this stupid hall. Because what does it matter, a hall? What's important, we have sort of companionship and friendship. People are more important than things. And so I asked forgiveness, and I said, having asked forgiveness for arguing with you, I ask a favor. First of all, two favors. First of all, can we build the hall your way? And number two, can I be the one who builds it? And my name is on the building license for that hall. I built that hall. Now, that's the way to solve problems. And I'm so proud that I did that. That was a Buddhist thing to do. To build a hall I never wanted to build. And even now I think it's a stupid hall. But I built it. And really, it's good enough. But even though it was a stupid hall, I built a beautiful relationship with that other monk. And that was more important. People are more important than things. So don't take things as the most important thing. Another good story. Because I've been teaching like this, I like to find out whether people understand these teachings. In my Buddhist society in Western Australia, you're not just a monk who just meditates. I'm also involved in administration. I'm the spiritual director. So I have to be on every committee meeting of our Buddhist society. And it's great having a monk at a committee, because it actually keeps the arguments down. You know, if there's a monk there, you feel very embarrassed to argue. So, on this one occasion, it came up in the committee meeting. There was a man, an Australian man, who'd given a $2,000 donation to our nuns' monastery. And he'd written a letter to the treasurer from Bangkok, saying he was overseas, he'd lost all his money, he was destitute, can he have his $2,000 back? And I never said anything, but I wanted to find out what my committee would say. And the treasurer had to put that letter forward to the committee. And he started by saying, I know our constitution backwards. Our constitution says it's actually illegal to give that donation back, because it's already been banked, it's in our accounts. But he said, that poor man is destitute. He needs the money. And after about 5 minutes of discussion, we took a vote, unanimous, to send the money back. And I was so proud of my committee that person, he was needing of money, and that's more important, you know, than having the money in the bank. Aren't we supposed to be compassionate and kind and generous? People are generous to me. Can't I be generous back? If people are generous to Champaka Buddhist Lodge, if people really, really need some help, can't we be generous back? So, our organization should be Buddhist first. No arguments, please solve them. There's something more important than being right, and that is being friends. So that's what I would do. Next question. Can you tell us a ghost story? It's pretty late at night. Can we dim the lights, please? I think you know most of my ghost stories. But let's think of what's a nice a new ghost story. This is a nice ghost story, a true one. I'm not sure if you heard this was a ghost in Adelaide. Because it's a true ghost story. It was in a Chinese restaurant in Adelaide. And I'll tell that another time, but reincarnation. I'll tell the story of the ghost. Now, what's the other ghost say? This is not a very scary ghost story, but it's a fascinating ghost story. Over in Perth, there is a ghost who rings doorbells, the doorbell ghost. A couple of Thai disciples, when they bought their new house, the real estate agent never told them that the previous owner was taking out his furniture. He was carrying a piece a bit too heavy and had a heart attack and died right in front of the door. Well, they bought the house, and every now and again the doorbell rang, and the owners of the house, the husband or the wife, would answer the doorbell and no one was there. They thought at first it could be a kid, because sometimes children play the game of ringing someone's doorbell and running away and hiding. But sometimes they were right next to the door when it rang. They opened it immediately, within a second, and no child could run that fast. And they investigated afterwards and found out there was someone who died right in front of the house only a couple of months before. So they assumed it was actually the ghost ringing the doorbell. But it got very, very irritating, because sometimes as a real visitor, they were ringing the doorbell. So should you answer it, should you not? In the end, the husband had a brainwave, an insight. It was one of these battery-driven doorbells. So he decided to take the batteries out, so the ghost couldn't ring the bell. Didn't work. Ghosts have their own power supply. The bell still rings even though there's no batteries in the bell. It's amazing. The ghosts are very, very clever. They can ring their own bell. Anyway, in golf, 60% of the success rate is in the short game. In meditation, how many percent would you rate insight compared to things going on outside? The short game. Okay. I suppose what you mean by the short game, you have to get the ball onto the green first of all. And it's actually the putting is the most important. But those of you who develop meditation, once you get into deep meditation, you get psychic powers. And when you putt that ball with a bit of mind control, you can actually get it to bend this way and that way. Tiger Woods meditates, apparently. Now you know his secret. Watching the ball, bend it this way, bend it that way. So in meditation, how many percent would you rate insight compared to things going on outside? I don't really understand that question, but it is true that when you actually meditate, it's you do bend the mind this way and that way by your insight. You see what's going on. If you're leaning to the left, you move to the right. If you're leaning to the right, you move to the left. So you balance the mind in peacefulness and stillness, and you use insight all the way in meditation. I'll mention that tomorrow morning to you yogis. Dear Ajahn, in the Amitabha Sutra, Sakyamuni Buddha praises Amitabha Buddha and all the other Buddhas. Simultaneously, all the other Buddhas also praise Sakyamuni Buddha for his teachings. Instead of following this, Buddhists nowadays tend to compare various practices or traditions, thinking one is better than the other. Ajahn, please advise all of us for the unity of Buddhism. Correct. It's a great thing, what the question you asked. Instead of comparing and saying, my Buddhism is better than your Buddhism, na 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 na. That's being a kid. And being sort of, you know, egotistical. You know, my teacher is more enlightened than your one. Or my God is more powerful than your God. And that's sort of very, very juvenile. Instead, we can actually respect each other. You all know the wonderful story of the elephant and the seven blind men. And I'll say it very quickly because I'm going to extend that story. The elephant and the seven blind men since the time they were born were shown an elephant. One was shown the trunk, another the tusks, another the ears, another the head, another the body, one the legs and one the tail. Saying, blind man, this is an elephant, feel it. The blind men had never seen an elephant before. Now they could feel it. Then they asked each man, what is an elephant? And having felt the elephant, the blind man who felt the trunk said it was a snake. One who felt the tusk said it was a plow. The one who felt the head of the elephant said it was a water pot. The one who felt the ear said it was a fan to keep you cool. The one who felt the body said it was a huge rock. The one who felt the leg said it was a tree trunk. And the one who felt the tail said it was a fly whisk. And they were all so convinced that they were right, as you would be, because that's your own personal experience, that they had an argument. And the moral of that story is that whether you follow Mahayana, Theravada, Christianity, Islam, whatever religion, have you got the full truth? Can you live long enough and go to every temple and read every book to understand everything about everything? Or is it the case we'll only be able to feel a part of the elephant? And so instead of having arguments, you know, between Buddhism or between religions or other religions or no religions, why wouldn't those blind men, instead of arguing what an elephant was, sit down, compare notes and combine their understanding of life? And then they would come to the conclusion, this thing called an elephant, which they would never see, is like a big rock on four tree trunks, with a fly whisk at the back. At the front, the other end, is a water pot with two fans on either side. In the middle, there's a snake with two plows on either side of the snake. Now, to a blind man, that would be a pretty accurate description of an elephant, wouldn't it? So why can't we actually combine instead of arguing? If we could only listen to each other and enjoy each other's different perspectives on life, we become far wiser. But I heard another extension of that story. There were 7 blind elephants. They'd always heard this word, man, man, man. What is a man? So they decided the only way to find out is to feel a man, you know, with their feet. They haven't got hands, they've just got feet. And after taking turns to feel a man with their feet, they all agreed that men were flat.
It's a great joke, I really like that one.
How to settle dispute in organisation or even Sangha according to Buddhist teaching. I think I've already got onto that. It's set your priorities. So it's not being right. That's not the most important thing. It's the Buddhist principles of compassion and harmony are more important than being right. And material things aren't important, people are. If you make people, Dhamma, compassion, the most important thing, how can you have a dispute? Dear Ajahn Brahm, I have downloaded one of your Dharma talks from the internet. In this Dharma talk you mentioned that there was a big supercomputer in the United States having a big problem, seeing that no expert can fix it. Then a time monk went to do some meta-charting on it and computer came back to normal. Now the computer is a man-made machine, so I'm just wondering, how does the meta-charting fix a machine? It's a great story, because I mean it shows again the power of meditation in our normal world. We found out this story began when this monk visited one of our monasteries in the United States, and when our monk looked at his passport, they found this Thai monk, a forest monk, had a diplomatic visa for life to enter the United States whenever he wanted. You don't get diplomatic visas for life these days in the age of terrorism. And this American monk wondered, what have you done to get this, you know, incredibly rare visa, a diplomatic visa to come and go whenever you want? And they found out the following story. In the headquarters of NASA, Houston, Texas, they had just installed a new mainframe computer. You can imagine, just NASA, they had the state-of-the-art computer. But once they'd installed it and installed all the software, they could not get it to work. And this was multi-millions of dollars. And they got the best experts from throughout the United States. You can't get better experts. No one could fix that machine and get it to work. And it was one of the geeks suggested in passing, if we can't fix it, perhaps it's something supernatural. That's what they said. You know, even in NASA, supposed to be, you know, one of the hardest scientific establishments in the world. And when he said that, someone else said, hey, actually, you know, there's a Thai monk who's got a great reputation, who's actually in Houston, he's visiting the Thai temple. Let's invite him in. So they invited him in to the mainframe computer room in the headquarters of the National Aeronautical and Space Association in Houston, Texas, the head of NASA. So he went in there, sat meditation for a little while, did some chanting, and from that point on the computer worked perfectly. It's a true story. And the head people in NASA were so impressed and grateful, they arranged to get this special visa for him, and a diplomatic visa for life as an act of gratitude, and perhaps also in case they ever needed him again. Amazing stories, what these, you know, meditators can do. You can fix your computers, but don't ask me to come around the next time your computer crashes. Dear Ajahn, when I was 19 years old, a wild dog hit by a car. After a few days, I found her. Her leg was broken and a lot of worms inside. I sent her to the vet. The vet said after he took all the worms out, the dog needed careful care and be kept away from flies. But I was in my pre-university exam and got no time to take care of her. The vet suggested to put her to diet as it will lessen her pain. At that time, I have decided for her life and let the vet put her to diet. I still think of my act at that time and thought that I can lessen her pain. Did I do the wrong decision, the wrong act? What would Ajahn think on this? How should I let the experience go? Number one, you're a very, very kind person because you took that dog in. Most people would just let it die right there. And they just pass it by. So number one, whoever wrote that question has got a lot of kindness and compassion. And you went to the vet, you probably had to pay your money to the vet to look after it. And you took the worms out, but you just didn't have the time to go right through and actually bring that dog to life. But you tried your best. We all have our limitations of time and money, and sometimes we just can't do it. But you tried. And so sadhu, 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 whoever wrote that question, you did your very, very best. So don't feel bad about you couldn't finish the job and bring that dog completely back to good health. At least you cared enough to give it a chance. But his karma, your karma, was not quite good enough. But you did your very best. So no bad karma. Don't think of what you didn't do. Think of what you did do. And that was wonderful. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. You're a very kind person. Venerable, not holding on to the fixed view. Please explain this phrase. Have you ever seen me say one thing one day and another thing the other day? That's like not holding to fixed view. Once upon a time, this is a Muslim story from the Mullah Nasruddin. Once upon a time, there was this salt trader who would make a lot of money by taking salt from one place to another and selling it. And his son was his assistant. But his son, being a teenager, would be rebellious. So whenever the donkey was leaning to the left, the father would tell his son, push the donkey to the left. Because he knew his son would do the complete opposite and push the donkey to the right. Therefore the donkey would be balanced. If the donkey was leaning to the right, he'd say, push it to the right. And then he'd push it to the left. You know what children are like, teenagers. And one day, they were going over a narrow bridge. The donkey was leaning to the left, and the father told his boy, push it to the left. And the boy pushed it to the left. The donkey fell in and drowned and lost all its salt. And the father was very upset, saying, what did you do that for? You know, I told you to push it to the left, but you know, I mean, you do the opposite. You've always done the opposite. Father, don't you realize it's my birthday today? I'm 20, I'm no longer a teenager anymore. So, sometimes you give different opinions or different ideas because you're talking to the person. Sometimes they're leaning to the left, you say go to the right. They're leaning to the right, go to the left. So a fixed view is only seeing things from one perspective. It's your fixed. So you only see one side of the thing. If you move to the other side, you see the other view. That's what we mean by fixed view. Having too much compassion but lack of wisdom causes more problem. Then is it possible that someone without the wisdom can lead others into the path of liberation? No. You need both wisdom and compassion. Usually we say that wisdom and compassion are the left wing and the right wing of a bird. And if only you have one wing, the bird flies around in circles, if it can fly at all. But if you have both wings, you can fly wherever you want to go. So those are the two wings of a bird, wisdom and compassion. Okay, quickly go through. Dear Ajahn, does transference of merit really work? How do other beings receive the merit? I've answered that already. When you die, if it doesn't work, come back and tell us. Ajahn Brahm, do ghosts really exist in this world? If yes, do they have any shape or form? How has their becoming originated and how their existence ends? Are they a form of energy or consciousness? You know, sometimes you don't know a ghost because they look just like an ordinary person. In fact, there could be one sitting next to you right now. So yeah, there are ghosts around. And they're called mind-made bodies. The mind makes the body. And it's true. One of the other ghost stories, there was this Australian man who lived in the town of Kalgoorlie, which is a mining town, maybe 200 miles, or maybe actually more than that, to the east of Perth. His friend was a disciple of mine. Victor was a friend. And when his friend, they're both in the building industry, when this Australian builder had cancer, he wasn't a Buddhist, but he had no religion at all. So his friend, my disciple, brought him to me a couple of times for counseling, a bit of chanting. But eventually his friend died in Kalgoorlie. And so he flew to that town for the funeral. But the funeral service was in, they had a closed casket, he was at the funeral service, did everything right, and then flew back again. He said one evening, sort of his wife nudged him with her elbow, at least so he thought. So he opened his eyes actually to tell his wife off, you know, stop waking me up. But he saw his wife completely asleep. And it was his friend, the ghost, by his bedside. And he saw him clearly. But what was really strange was his friend, an Australian builder. Some of you have been to Australia. Now, builders especially, they don't really dress up. But this man was in a suit with a bow tie. He'd never seen his friend ever in a suit. Say not a bow tie, he was an Australian builder. But he turned around to his wife. I forget what this guy's name was. George was. It wasn't George, but Harry. Harry, that was his name. And he said, Harry's here, to his wife, wake up. And his wife woke up, he turned around and Harry was gone. And actually they both of them got up and searched the whole house for Harry, for the ghost. But they obviously never found him. So he went back to sleep again. But what really worried him was he saw Harry dressed up in a suit and a bow tie. So he thought a little bit, he talked to me, and I told him, why don't you ring up the wife? And just don't ask leading questions, but ask the wife, you know, after saying condolences, how are you going? If you don't mind me asking, and this is what he did, he asked the wife, what was Harry wearing in the coffin? Because it was closed. The wife said, well, actually, he had this old suit he never wanted to wear, but I thought at least at his funeral he could wear this suit for one last time. Did he have a tie on? A bow tie, said the wife. And so the man was just so impressed that a suit which he never even knew the guy had, and a tie which he would never imagine could exist. That's what his wife dressed him up in the coffin, and that's what his ghost was wearing. That's actually what happens. So sometimes, please don't be to be scared. The ghosts are very kind and nice and cute and lovable. You can't cuddle a monk, but try cuddling a ghost. They love it. Metta. What is the difference between an arahat's metta and a layperson? The power of it. Arahat's metta is incredibly powerful. What is the meaning of sadhu? It means it is well, it is well, it is well. I'll go through these quickly. Is Abhidharma taught by the Buddha to his mother in Tara Tings of Heaven? No. The Abhidharma was composed much later, after the time of the Buddha. I get into trouble for that, but that's true. I said to the youth today, Buddhism has to be one of the two... I'll backtrack. There are two types of religion in today's world. Two types of religion. One bends the facts to fit the faith. The other one bends the faith to fit the facts. Buddhism should always be the second type, bending the faith to receive knowledge to fit the facts. It's been well established beyond any doubt at all the Abhidharma was composed well after the time of the Buddha's Parinibbana. The language is different, the concepts are different, and you can date sutras. In the same way, if you look at a newspaper 20 years ago, 40 years ago, 100 years ago, the language changes. An example of that, 50 years ago, you may say you went to London and had a very gay time. And all it would have meant was you had a happy time in London. Nowadays, if you said you had a gay time, it means you were homosexual. Words change their meaning. And because they change their meaning, you could actually date when that thing was written. And the Abhidharma was about at least one or two centuries after the time of the Buddha. So it was not part of the original teachings. And even in the Vinaya Pitaka, they give the account of the first council where the teachings of the Buddha were recorded, and it says clearly there that the Arahat Upali recited the Vinaya, and Ananda recited the five Nikayas. And everybody knows the five Nikayas are the Digha Nikaya, the Majjhima Nikaya, Sanyutta Nikaya, Anguttara Nikaya, and Kudaka Nikaya. There's no mention at all of Abhidharma. The Abhidharma came after the time of the Buddha. Ajahn Brahm, how is it possible to learn anything from a really boring lecturer that made you fall asleep every time you went into his class? What you learn is to respect interesting lecturers. I am a science student, so the subjects are rather difficult to understand on my own, even with my friends around. And also, in my university, most of the time it is impossible to ask questions to anyone else except that boring lecturer, because only he specializes in that subject. The answers that he gives end up making me more confused. What should I do so that I won't end up failing my studies? It is one of the problems in schools, colleges, and universities that that particular lecturer may be expert, he knows everything about what he's talking about, but he hasn't got the skill to expound it to others and allow other people to understand. In the same way, there are some monks who are just fully enlightened, they're great monks and great nuns, but they just can't give a Dhamma talk. They know from experience what enlightenment is, but they can't impart it to other people. But unfortunately, you get a job as a lecturer in university, not because you're a good teacher, just because, you know, you've passed your PhD, you're a good researcher. And that's a huge weakness. If you do get someone who's a great lecturer, who knows what they're talking about, oh, that is so inspiring. When I was at university, the professor of physics at that time was a guy called Fred Hoyle. He started the steady state theory of cosmology. It was Stephen Hawking sort of beat him with the Big Bang theory. But he was such an inspiring lecturer. He also writes science fiction books as well. And once I went to a lecture of his. It was the 100th anniversary of the Astronomical Society, of which I was a member. And the Astronomical Society had hired, or had actually got the chemistry theatre, the biggest lecture theatre in Cambridge at that time. Fortunately, I got the time wrong and arrived 1 hour earlier. So I actually got a seat. Almost the whole university was there for this lecturer. You didn't have to be a physicist to appreciate it. People were in the aisles, they were in the foyer, they were crowded all over the place. The B lecture, the warm-up, was from the guy who discovered quasars. And the A lecture was from Professor Fred Hoyle. And I remember that lecture to this day. It was just so inspiring. That guy's mind was just so interesting. And he could express what he was thinking. And when you come across like a great scientist who could also lecture, oh, that's just so moving and inspiring. That was one of the best moments of my life in Cambridge, to listen to such a great speaker expound on heaps of things in physics. And that, you know, almost made me never become a monk and be a physicist after learning, listening to someone like that. But fortunately I did become a monk, but it's a tough one.
But at least you have the internet,
and you can actually find lectures from the internet on that subject. You can find other ways of gaining that knowledge, fortunately, in today's world. But you probably find that that lecturer, that if you really approach him or her at the right time, with the right mind state, they will explain things to you. And just say to them, look, what do you mean by that? And a lot of times that people are kind enough to spend time to actually explain it to you, if they know you're really interested. But if not, try the internet. Is it wrong to allow another being to end his own life? Well, it's not wrong, not right, it's their karma. If at all possible, you try and influence them to extend their life, but sometimes that it's not really your business. You know, you try to do your best, but in the end, we're the owners of our own karma. My question is about the food that is offered to the monks. Is it all right for the devotees to eat the leftover food? I hope you do, because people offer me so much. If you didn't eat it, I don't know who would. I was told if the monks did not offer back the leftover food to the devotees, then the devotees should not eat the food. Please clarify. No. You don't need to offer it back. You please take it. Because monks are kind, and they want to share things. So you can take it as given that, you know, the monks want to share whatever they have with you. It's, after all, it's, you know, when you offer food, it's not my food, it's your food. And I'm so very grateful you offer me something to eat every day. And so obviously, we share food. So if you need some, please take it. Is there any basis to the belief that by releasing birds, animals, one can prolong one's lifespan? Can such acts prolong the life of a person afflicted with a terminal illness? Please elaborate. Sometimes people release birds and fishes. You know, there's some temples in Thailand where the birds are well trained. As soon as you release them from the front of the temple, they fly back to the back of the temple. They go round and round and round. They earn a lot of money for the monks, and they also get well fed because that's their job. So actually, they're very happy birds. It's just their livelihood, that's all. But be careful, because sometimes you can release a bird or a fish and it can't survive in the wild, because it's actually been, you know, in close to humans for so long, it just can't fend for itself. It hasn't learned how to do that. So a bird may have been in the cage for many years, it just can't fly. So all you can do is look after it in the cage, but be kind to it. Or the fish won't be able to survive in those rivers. It needs a special habitat. So if you do release animals, make sure that you're releasing them into a proper life, not into their imminent death. But, you know, it's a nice, compassionate thing to do. But there's other ways you can increase your life. And one of them is by being kind, meditating, don't be so worried. One of the people I really respect, because he was wise, but he was a scallywag, but he was a funny man, George Burns, the American comedian. The reason I respect him, because he had, a lot of comedians are very sharp, they're very wise. Because he died just before his 100th birthday, or just afterwards. But anyway, when he was 97, on his birthday, he was interviewed, and his interview was in a magazine, which I read, and one of the questions they asked him was, say, now, Mr. Burns, you're 97 years of age, you eat fatty food, you drink alcohol, you smoke, I don't know how many cigars a day, and you stay up late at night to 1, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning in the nightclubs. My goodness, you're 97! Aren't you worried about your lifestyle's effect on your health? And he replied immediately, I am not worried. My wife, she was worried, and that's why she died 20 years ago. The reason why you laugh at that, because there's so much truth in that. It's the worry which kills you more than anything else. So if you want to live a long life, don't worry. Dear Ajahn, I hear you mention your dad on many occasions, but hardly hear you mention about your mum and brothers and sisters. Can you tell us a bit about her? How old is she now? How many brothers and sisters do you have? Is your family close together? Do you visit each other often?
You know what? Is this Oprah Winfrey show?
Okay, once upon a time a man was shot by an arrow. Before he would pull the arrow out, he wanted to know who shot the arrow, who his mother was, how many brothers and sisters he had, instead of cutting out. Yeah, my mother, she's 78 now, she lives in London, I've got one brother, he's a bank manager, I'm a Buddhist monk, opposite sides of the spectrum, but now I'm going to teach his bosses how to do business. And no sisters, her family are close together, I'll be visiting her next April. Being a monk, do you need to renounce, let go of family relations? No, actually become a better son, a better daughter, a better brother or sister once you become a monk or a nun. And my mother's really proud of me being a monk. When a person stops having rebirth, where does being go after he died? Is the being just vanished completely from this universe? Aha, you will find out. A couple of days, is it tomorrow? No, tomorrow is enlightenment, isn't it? Yeah, tomorrow you will find out in a talk on enlightenment. So, two questions to go, just 10 o'clock, great. There are some Buddhists who pride themselves on being able to take the 8 precepts because they believe this will help them to be reborn in heaven. The same for those who try to do as many dhanas, offering of food to Sangha as possible. Is this true? Okay, this is what we call spiritual materialism. When you go to your friend and say, how many dhanas have you done? And you say, 3? Only 3. Oh, I've done 23. What monks did you get? I got the chief reverend. I can't get him anymore, he's passed away. The people who go to heaven are the ones who don't go around telling people what they do, who don't go sort of telling people how many dhanas they've done or how many great monks they've invited or how many times they kept precepts. These are just people who renounce their ego, renounce their self, and sometimes they think, my goodness, these monks, they get so busy coming to this house and that house, and I don't want them to come to my house for dhana, but I would join in somebody else's house. And that way the monk doesn't have to be bothered going to all these places. They can have more free time to meditate or to teach. Because sometimes you can spend all your time going to this person's house and that person's house. If you go to one person's house, they say, look, I've been looking after you much longer than her. Why didn't you come to my house? And in the end, oh, you go to so many houses, you're never at home. People come and look for you in your monastery, you're never there. So the nicest thing is being like a wise. If you really want to make good karma, how can I help? How can I serve? And one of the nicest ways is what you're doing now, to try and, instead of feeding the monks with lots and lots of food, or giving them so many robes, how many robes do I need to wear? I've only got one robe. One robe at a time, but people always like to offer monks robes. Why instead don't you sponsor, say, CDs or a Dhamma book? Because that way the Dhamma really goes far and wide. And then you're robing people with Dhamma rather than with pieces of cloth. So we have to actually think and not just follow traditions. You know that once in Thailand, a general had a dream. His dream was that he'd been giving food to the monks, but his father up in heaven was thirsty because every time he offered food, but he never offered water. And from that time on, he put an article in the newspapers, when I went on alms round, I got so many bottles of water in my bowl, there was no space for any food. And they were really heavy. That was a stupid, superstitious thing to believe in. So, no, be reasonable, be rational. And that's the best way you can help the sasana. I cannot take the 8 precepts, cause Precept number 7, to abstain from taking food at an inappropriate time. That's precept number 6. But never mind. Due to health reason, will this any way be a hindrance in my meditation practice when going for retreat? No. Many people go on my retreats, and if for some health reason, such as they are diabetic, or they have to take some medicine in the evening, and if they don't take something solid, they will get a tummy ache, then they just ask me and ask the managers, and you'll arrange to get something, solid to, help digest the medicine. The whole point of the precepts is to have a little bit of restraint, not to give you a hard time. So all you need to do is just to ask, and then those rules will be adapted to suit you. And that means you can go on retreat, you're still keeping the spirit of the 8 precepts by not having a big meal in the afternoon or evening. Maybe just have a biscuit or a sandwich or something. There's something simple just to get you by that health problem. But still you can do the retreats and you can still keep the 8 precepts. It's not really 8 precepts, it's called the 7.5 precepts. But it's close enough. So there goes the last question on the Deep Insight Talk. So hopefully you learned something today. And when you go from here, you remember something more than just my jokes. I've seen a few people taking notes, and I hope it's notes about the Dhamma, not the jokes, so you can tell your friends when you go back to work tomorrow morning, the story of the man who got lost in the Himalayas, and all the other jokes which I said today. So again, that's a little bit of entertainment in order to make the Dhamma talk a bit more useful for you, a bit more interesting, but many of those jokes have serious messages behind them. And when you understand the message and the joke, you remember everything, become a better human being and a more tolerant, kind person. So may you all be happy and well. Now we'll do the sharing of merits. Idam men yati nang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idam men yati nang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idam men yati nang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Now 3 happy sadhus. Sadhu. Sadhu.
Sadhu.
Very good. Tomorrow, enlightenment. So you don't want to miss this. This is a pinnacle, but many people will miss it because the talk coming afterwards is reincarnation and ghosts and spirits and things which go woo, woo, woo. So that's coming on Friday night. So tomorrow night, enlightenment, Friday night, reincarnation and ghosts, and the last talk on Saturday, laughing all the way to Nirvana. Take care.